We're going to actually move straight into the next panel, Black and Green. Someone did reference Earth Song, and we actually are going to start the panel by looking at it. But I would like to first introduce the moderator, Mr. Walker Sands. Walker is an alumni of Time Warner's New Line Cinema and the Jackie Robinson Foundation. Walker brings experience in human resources management, clientele development, and media marketing to the green economy consultancy, Majora Carter Group. Awesome. Welcome. So, welcome to Black and Green, again, debunking the myths that Black and Green, that Black people are not at all interested in the green movement. And so, we're going to start with Earth Song.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome everyone to Black and Green, and we want to debunk the myth today that we are people that are very much vested and should be invested in sustainability. Like I said, my name is Walker Sands, and I'm from the Majora Carter Group, a Bronx-based green development project firm that holds fast that you should not have to leave your community in order to live in a better one. And one of the keys to doing that is to make sure that we are incorporating all people and all resources in a responsible and green way. So first off, I'm going to be selfish and give my reaction to this video, and I can say if that was very black and it was very green. When I look at that video, there's so much that Michael did, obviously, as a musical innovator, where he's using these black tools of gospel, call and response, pretty much uniting, giving a very strong message about the value of all these people that he's showing, from whether they be from the Amazon or Croatia, what have you. And so I think that that in itself is an example of how, you know, our culture and our artistic, you know, voices are very powerful and are often a go-to voices for important messages when it comes to environmental rights, people's rights, and the rights of our earth. And so I'm going to stop hogging the spotlight and get into this very important panel. We have some amazing people with us today, so I please encourage you to check out their biographies that are in the program. And other than saying wow, I'm going to turn to my colleague here, Andres Connor Marino, and I just have to ask you, you know, just to embarrass you right off the bat, you know, you're a Fulbright scholar. You've been working in green and green technology for many different communities from the Bronx to Brazil. And when you see that video and looking at that worldly message of Earth Song, how does it make you feel? What does it bring up for you?
Well, it's interesting that you should bring up it's very black and it's very green. I also feel that additionally it's very in between, because a lot of communities are shown that really don't relate to the African-American community directly. But I think the important message is that all those people do matter, and this is a global issue. I think that's what kind of hits hardest to me. And also not to forget about those people that are often overlooked in indigenous communities and in places that we often, I think, through media tend to cast a negative light on.
Mm-hmm. And also, Anissa, really happy to have you here with us, Ms. Anissa Keith. You're a very much needed voice in sustainability. I think it's very powerful just that, as you know, as a woman of color, you command business opportunities in the area of sustainability. And being also of higher education and knowing the importance of what it is to spread message, when you see that video, what does it bring and what does it make you think about in regard to your mission?
Well, I would say that Michael was definitely planting a seed about sustainability, about the environment, about animal rights or protecting animals, and also about war. I would say that it's almost a simplistic view of some very large socioeconomic factors.
Mm-hmm.
For example, let's say in the case of the rainforest, what's not known is that a lot of those local indigenous people might themselves be tearing down the rainforest, clear-cutting, burning, because it's the only way that they have to create a livelihood. And many of them, if you ask them, why are you cutting down the forest, they have financial needs that they have no other way of meeting. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, the issue of sustainability is not just about green products at Walmart. It is also about, you know, people having ways of sustaining themselves, be it sustainable agriculture or livelihoods for people who might otherwise be taking tusks from elephants, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would say he's definitely raising an issue and he's planting a seed. And 14 years ago or 15 years ago when this video was first made, that was a very new topic for a lot of people because they weren't really aware of just that issue. In terms of my group, I basically started a green business community. So, you know, the mission of our committee is really to provide educational opportunities and also networking for people in the Columbia Business School alumni community and then others in the business community. So what we do is we've put on a green business series called Making Green from Green, and we've invited a lot of speakers from the business world, people from wind farms, people who've started energy companies that are green fuels. We've had people who invest in those technologies. We've had people who are in IT and they're also creating new applications for energy efficiency in that area. We've had just a range of speakers in the business community. And I think in terms of green, it's not it's something that takes a large it takes the input of our government. It takes the input of businesses who create new products and new new economic opportunities, and also it takes a concerned citizenry. So it's kind of like a multi-tiered, I'd say, effort.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I mean, and Anissa really knows in terms of, and like many of the panelists that are here with us today, you know, you have these products like GreenWorks. It's really more about how green works and how it puts people to work. And I think that, you know, just to kind of give you an idea of how this panel will go, and we're looking forward to your questions, whether they be around our thoughts on Michael's green efforts and just our specifically, hopefully, as well as the opportunities that are here for, again, not just, you know, focusing just on the African-American community, even though I think it's very, very relevant, the idea of how we self-empower. This will be a great, I think Michael gives us a great template and it gives us a great call to actually inform ourselves. I think that's really, for me, has always been the power of Michael, and it's the power of, hopefully, of this panel today for you guys. And so, you know, last but not least, oh, the wonderful Mr. William Thomas, who does some very important work in community-building organizations around the nation, and also, dare I say, internationally, has had some great impacts for getting people up to speed and getting people, again, empowered to take more responsibility for themselves and their earth. And so looking at that video and kind of seeing an angry earth, I mean, if you look at the kind of the prophecy that went behind that video where pretty much Katrina happened at the end of the video, you had people kneeling like they were in church, and the next thing you know, the earth is responding to how you know, she has or he has, whatever, how the earth has been treated, and really the power of that and how he took a very, you know, what I would call a very African-American experience and informed it on a world scale. And looking to you, Mr. Thomas, how did you feel about this video in respect to your work?
Well, in respect to the work, I mean, I grew up with Michael. We basically would have been the same age if he was still alive. And I think one of the things about Michael that impresses me more than anything was his ability to create and to be diverse and to think out of the box. You know, in the work that, you know, has been going on the last few years in the green sector and seeing people of color and people in general having the opportunity to embrace something that we absolutely must for the future of our planet, for the future of our children. One of the most interesting things about the video, as a matter of fact, Walker, I watched it again this morning, and I think the one thing that sticks out in my mind at the end of the video, the elephant that is laying on the ground, his tusks come back, and he gets up off the ground, and he brushes himself off, and he goes on as nothing had happened. The one interesting thing about this movement right now, and, you know, green was first a buzzword, then it became fashionable. Now it's, you know, almost a mainstream item. But I think back to my grandmother, and, you know, when I was growing up as a little boy and we used to go visit her in Alabama, she was about as green as it got. She recycled everything. She reused anything around the house that she possibly could. And, you know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and they said, you know, people of color have really been green forever because they've had to just adjust and take what's in front of them and, you know, use the things that others maybe have that they don't have. Or should I say they've always been able to adjust. I think one of the things that, you know, when we look at the environment, and we look at communities, and we look at neighborhoods, it saddens me a little bit sometimes when I go into neighborhoods and I just see the abuse of, say, litter, and people not really giving or caring about their community. And I think, you know, one of the things that Michael was able to do repeatedly was to draw this inner presence out of us to really evaluate who we were as a person, people, who we were as a planet, who we were as a race. You know, again, watching the video again this morning and just seeing again a few minutes ago, I'll go back to that elephant story. The great thing about green right now in the community, you know, the president definitely put money into people's hands to help others that normally would not have that opportunity for help to raise up. So the elephant story, you know, kind of impacts me that way. I see a lot of people right now getting off the ground that normally would not be having the opportunity to get off the ground. The window of opportunity is small and it is closing, so we must act quickly and swiftly, or we will be passed by once again. And if you look at the opportunities that are available, at the turn of the century, we took the horse from out in front of the buggy, we put a motor in it, we called it a car, and that was the boom of the transportation industry. 15 years ago, my son's in the audience, I never will forget, right when he was born, we got our first quote-unquote computer with internet connection, and a new industry was born. Well, this is truly an opportunity of a new industry being birthed, and that industry including and not excluding normally what is left out. So, in my opinion, we must move swiftly, but the opportunity is there, and it's an exciting time. So,
very much so. I like the elephant story. Definitely makes sense. I mean, you see how things are regenerated. Like, in all those instances, you're seeing this call for people to pick up, dust themselves off. You're seeing this image of people who are not people and things, the earth itself, restoring itself. And a lot of people have spoken of this new green movement, which is, you know, the establishment of green jobs, the establishment of more energy-safe, energy-conscious tools and how we do daily business in our buildings and within ourselves and how we recycle, and how that is our chance to literally have healthier lives. And the great thing about sustainability is how interconnected it is with everything from food access to, you know, the quality of life on your block. And that's a great point that you bring up, William, about how important it is to how do we invest in ourselves. They say, you know, you look in your garbage can and that's, you can get a good sense of who that person is. But I think it's very true to, you know, how do we use, how do we waste, how do we conserve, how do we care? And I think that going to the next part, really the idea of a challenge, I think, when we talk about, you know, the things ahead of us, we're very excited about green. Green's everywhere. Everyone wants to jump and shout and scream and talk about, oh, green jobs, and everyone from every political party has some kind of green job promised, and it really escapes a lot of people what exactly they're talking about, purposefully so, I'm sure. But I think that, like many of the people here with me today, they have very clear understandings, and they're going to be giving you examples of opportunities and jobs and how you can restructure your life to have a more healthful living on a fiscal and physical manner. So going back to challenges, though, you saw, you know, we see an Earth Song, we saw the war, and we saw the Amazon rainforest coming down. Anissa brought up the very important point that these are really complex issues that were projected in a very simple way for people to understand urgency. Just like they thought when I was doing research on the song, Earth Song itself, they were talking about how it was a very simple melodic chant that he decided he would use while he was sitting in Austria. Speaking of, you know, otherworldly, outside, out of the box, you know, he was in Austria in a hotel room and he wrote this song, obviously incorporating all his talents, all his influences, American, African-American, worldly, whatever you want to, or just the many things that go into who his musical genius was, and use those simple chants to show, you know, this main message. And I think it's important to know that, you know, when the cutting down of the rainforest, it's very accurate that many of the indigenous people, often forgotten in this country and in this side of the world, they are now forced into that lifestyle because their economy has forced them away from sustainable living that they had established for thousands of years. And so I think that education of how to get back to that, or education of how we can apply these new tools, is very important. And that's why I'm really happy that you guys are here, because everyone on this panel is very much an educator. Anyone who is entering into and jumping onto the sustainability movement, they'll be an educator before it's all over. And I wanted to ask you, Andres, you know, as a Fulbright scholar and someone who's done great work with educating our youth in terms of what green technologies are, and, you know, whether it was Green Fab and all these different projects, you know, what would you say is really the best approach to bring someone in on this? Really, it's a big world, and there's so many different facets to it. You know, what's really your approach when you're dealing with young kids, even, you know, who don't have a higher education or an education in economics?
Well, it's really difficult to find an exact approach where to begin, but I guess with children, I often find that topics of morality, like when we begin to discuss what's right and wrong, is very easy to approach with people who are just younger than 18. That's at least my experience. Mm-hmm. In the Bronx and in Brazil, in the slum communities. So I feel like it's a little bit different with adults who have responsibilities, have to meet some financial needs like paying rent, etc. It's a little bit easier just to convince younger people that they can make a change, that they can have fun being green or working in an area of sustainability. And I think ultimately, though, the older they get, this issue becomes pressing about how to make it profitable. And so those are, I believe those are really the two main points dealing with young people, and really trying to use education and sustainability as a tool to bring any community forward.
Mm-hmm. Like, say, so when you're working in GreenFab, and I guess if you could just quickly say what GreenFab is. I'm talking you all know what it is. I just happen to be down the block from where he does this great work. But if you could just give the audience an idea of this really important work you do.
Sure. GreenFab is a program being held at Sustainable South Bronx, which is, like he said, a block away from Majora Carter Group. And Sustainable South Bronx is actually created by Majora Carter. And it's a really interesting program because it's sort of the program that's for younger people, interns from a local high school. And there's another program there called the Best Eco Program, which trains, more adults than anything and much older than high school students in skills that they can apply for green jobs so that they can qualify for green jobs, like working in the Recreation and Park Services Department. And so with the younger folks, what we tend to do is work with a lot more theoretical ideas about the potential of using design towards sustainability. We have that opportunity with younger people because of what I just mentioned. There's not a pressing issue to address the profitability of being green. So on one, it's sort of divided into two labs. One of them is physical computing. The other one is sustainable design. And I work in the sustainable design part. I'm able to actually introduce a lot of my own ideas, research ideas that I encountered. Well, I say research conflicts that I encountered while I was doing my research in Brazil on how to produce ecological materials for a more sustainable construction. I also focus a little bit more on what I told Denise earlier, something called the bioclimactic architecture, which is not easy for people to understand, but it's basically using natural systems to basically meet the demands of what is needed in a built environment. Like, we have air conditioning right now that's artificial. There's natural ways to air condition an environment. And these more rely on issues of design, how you can approach design and design a specific environment so that you can utilize natural resources or natural conditions like wind, etc., or water, which has a great heat capacity storage. So these are some of the issues that we address, and I feel like because it's a little bit more theoretical and less practical, students around like the age of like 13, 14, 15, 16 are more willing to accept that. The ones that are a little bit older that are about to graduate high school are a lot more concerned about getting into college and or finding a job. So mm-hmm. Does that clarify things?
Yeah, and it does kind of speak to the idea of innovation too, and how these kids are pretty much, they're ready to look at those new fangled ways of running the world. Just like, you know, William said earlier about, you know, putting a motor in a horse, this idea of having a mechanical horse draw you around town. That sounded like witchcraft to a lot of people, probably 10 years before it even happened. And you brought up another point. It's about, you know, the natural use of air and water. And it goes back to a couple points, I think, for Anissa and for William, where they talked about, you know, black folks, you know, I'm originally from down south, so I had my grandmother with her chicken coop in the back. And, you know, and that's where we got our eggs, and that's where we got chicken sometimes, too. The idea of how you use water, I was taught that when our air conditioner broke, and I was being a spoiled, you know, black American prince, and I was like, you know, where's the air conditioner and all this stuff, and I'm fussing and complaining. And my mom said, take a pan of water, put some ice in it, put a fan in front of it, and blow it around the room, and your room is cool, and you're good, sit down and be quiet. And I feel like that was really, I mean, we're looking at people, and we say this about in the American context, and for newcomers to the country, I do speak of it from the context of, as an African American, like the idea of being sustainable, taking what people literally throw away and make it into something that's going to work for and sustain your family. And I think that brings a good point. When we talk about business opportunities and transgressing class, Michael, you know, grew up on 2300 Jackson Street in a family of a whole bunch of children. We all know that he had several brothers and sisters living in one house, and what that must have meant to be in about a two-room home. And you've got, you know, at least five times the children for those rooms. And you know they were, you know, working with neck bones or working with, you know, conserving water all the time. You know they were watching the electricity bill. You know that was going on. And this, so to go from that experience, and then you are the king of pop, and you have a Neverland Ranch that has, I think, a carousel that by itself, I was looking it up, took up thousands of dollars in energy, money, towards the energy of running, you know, his personal world. And I don't beget him that. I'm not one to worry about folks. People worry about black folks' money a little too much. I would not ever say, Michael, you can't have this, or let's ever judge him that way. But I think it does present a challenge of when we see, you know, you've grown up not having, and then you've earned, or, you know, you've been granted great access. And that's a beautiful thing. But how can we then be responsible, as we all in this room or many people that we know want to make sure that we're jumping on board these green opportunities? I would love to ask you, Anissa, you know, how at SBC, Sustainable Business Committee at Columbia, how do you address those that might see green as poor? Like, if you say you're going back to sustainability, that means going back to, you know, digging in the dirt, or even people who wouldn't want to look at jobs that are, you know, at the parks. They don't necessarily want to do those kinds of jobs, or they might see there are other, they might want other opportunities. What would you tell that person?
I don't know that I could really address not wanting to work at the park. I mean, if you, there's nothing wrong with doing an honorable job that is, in fact, helping your environment and the environment of those where you live. So that's my.
I was really glad that you. That's why I wanted you to say.
What I would say about green and the dichotomy, I guess, between affluence and sustainability, which I think is what you're asking about.
Yeah, like how much of that is a myth, or.
You sent the question earlier, and I had to think about it. My first thought was, well, obviously it's a $230 billion business. Mm-hmm. Walmart wouldn't be in this if there weren't money in it. Mm-hmm. So there is a whole money question. There are businesses, obviously. You know, at one point, GE had a backlog of wind turbine orders for $12 billion. This is real money. So companies are throwing money at this. On the other hand, you have... if you looked at a population such as the villagers in the video, people like that don't live in an environment where they have plastic bags that will be here for the next 1,000 years until they biodegrade. Mm. They don't have SUVs. They don't have consumer electronics, Nike shoes, all of the things that we use and discard that end up in a landfill. And as we move up the economic chain from the villager to the person living in the suburban house shopping at Costco, we're here in America, we're buying lots of things and we're throwing them away, and they are not sustainable. They live in a landfill. Mm-hmm. And that's where they'll be for the next several thousand years. So people, as they progress and make money, they do consume more things that are not green. That's the reality where we're living. On the other hand, we have now a green industry, and that says, hey, you yuppies and you cultural elite. I mean, that's who's really on board with it initially. Mm-hmm. Like, hi, you, this is a business. I have organic food for you. I have, you know, green products to clean your home. And I think some people feel like, oh, the green thing is white, mm-hmm. not necessarily for black people. We've been green for centuries, as you say. Right, but there's kind of this movement it's creating a lifestyle that says green is buying these particular yuppie products. So there's that too. Mm-hmm. And then I think what I've noticed from talking to a lot of consumer products makers who are in the green sphere, consumers will ultimately buy green when it benefits them. It's really about my environment versus the environment. So mm-hmm. when oil is at $147 a barrel, that energy efficient car starts to look really good. You know, when you want to buy a new appliance and you see the Energy Star sticker that says save $100 a year by buying this one versus that one where you only save 200 or $20 a year, all of a sudden the energy efficient appliance looks good. When you're worried about Frankenfoods and you're worried about the hormones that are injected in the cows and the antibiotics and the chicken, and you know you're getting frightened about our food supply, then all of a sudden buying food that's grown sustainably nearby at a farm that's you know closer to where you live, food that's organic, all of these things all of a sudden start to look appealing. So ultimately, people are kind of engaging in the movement based on their own self-interest, largely. I mean, obviously, there are those, you know, our government, to a certain extent, plays a role, and fortunately, Obama has put money into helping create a green economy, so there's that. There are businesses that are involved, some for altruistic reasons, like a seventh generation, some because, you know, Walmart, you know, it's business. They sell one-third of pretty much everything you could think of. All one-third of all men's socks is sold in Walmart. They have 8,400 stores. So one-third of all men's watches is Walmart. When, you know, they're the largest, they got into organic foods, they're the largest seller of green of organic foods. They get into green household chemicals, green products, they're the largest seller of green products. So, you know, Walmart is motivated by making money. And obviously, you know, when you're a $400 billion a year company, you know? And you get into an industry, you're shifting the market. So, you know, yes, there's money in it. Yes, there is this kind of yuppie culture that's being sold to. Yes, as we all in America consume more stuff, which is that's what our country is, it's about consuming at this point. You know, we're leaving a waste stream behind us. And they're getting back to the gentleman who didn't, or woman who doesn't want to work in the park. As I said, there's nothing wrong with doing something that's helping the environment where you live and helping the next seven generations. That's why that company is called Seventh Generation. It's a Native American term that meant anything you do, like buying this pen, affects the next seven generations. So, you know, I think people do become aware of environmentalism as it benefits them, but slowly, slowly, people are starting to be aware, you know, as they start to become aware of it to help themselves, I think they'll also think about the larger environmental issue.
That's right. I'm really impressed by your math skills, by the way. You were breaking down barrels of oil, and it's going to cost you $20, and then your heat goes down, and I was like, okay, here
you
go.
I worked in Wall Street for a long time, and I used to buy the stock of Walmart, et cetera.
Well, so that's, you remember it, which is impressive. But again, I know that was a really great point that you brought up. I think, you know, going back to William, I wanted to make sure you dropped in on that as well, because there is the person that I happened to be speaking to was a person looking for work, and it was kind of a funny comment. It kind of was a hit-home comment where she said, you know, well, I know they're making jobs for people to go and tend to the park, but I feel like we've done fields already. Now, and I think that at the same time, you know, there is an idea, you know, being responsible for your environment that goes beyond who we are and our personal experiences, and it also touches our personal experience. But I would also say that, you know, for those kinds of sensitivities, those are important to acknowledge. And so I think it's great how, you know, committees like yours and also William, I'm about to ask William about, you know, talks about jobs that are a little more accessible to people's minds, kind of like Andres when you talked about people thinking about the rent as opposed to elephants in Africa. What's going to make that more real to see the connection between the importance of green technology? So I was wondering, William, what are your thoughts when you talk about these the new green industry and what it brings us?
Well, I want to follow up on a few things that my colleague here said for the audience. First of all, the consumption idea. You know, we were programmed by the Roosevelt administration to consume. At 9/11, George Bush told us to go back and shop. I'd like to give everybody a wonderful website. The website is called The Story of Stuff. It's a 20-minute animated film that many of you may have already seen, but from, you know, elementary school education to senior citizens seeing the story, it really opens your mind and awareness to what we've been programmed to do in America to feel successful. You know, the Walmart theory, 2 years ago I was in a think tank when green was just really kind of, you know, getting its legs underneath it, and some pretty interesting people were involved in the think tank. And the question was posed was, what's the consumer in America's perception of the greenest company in America? And believe it or not, it was Walmart. And it was not because of their practices at that point in time. It was because they sold CFL light bulbs. because at that point in time, that was the connection to green in the average American's mind, and potentially still is. You know, when you throw numbers around about this industry, we've been able to create a lot of jobs, and a lot of the training that we're doing is in energy efficiency. That sector alone over the next 10 years is $1.2 trillion, not billion, $1.2 trillion. And the interesting thing about it is when you look at energy and efficiency, you're already spending the money. So when I look up in the ceiling here or I walk into the Schomburg, and I know that the work that we're doing in the community already of reducing electrical consumption, and we can cut 30 to 50% the electrical consumption of any building in America, not to mention that we could power it literally for free. The sun creates enough energy in 1 hour, to power the entire world for an entire year. Wow, imagine that. So there's a few green jobs right there down the road. But let me just give you some things that are real and that are happening throughout the United States, and really even more so right here in your community. The one thing about the youth that I find very encouraging and empowering, you know, typically speaking, people of color have a not so high success rate of graduating high school, then going on to college, graduating, and then going out into the real world and competing. I blame a lot of that on the fact that we have to be fathers first, and if we were, a lot more of our children would grow up to be real adults and not have the issues or go through the experiences that they go through. But when we take kids right off the corner, and I mean literally right off the corner, we just had the pleasure of taking a gang member from Crown Heights and putting him through energy efficiency training and graduating him right out into a job. We've seen the transformation. I have a project manager right now working on a $68 million Con Edison project, and he just came back from 15 years of incarceration, and he's 58 years old. He would not have gotten a job. He'll probably make X of six figures this year based on his ability to get up every day and just function as a human being. So he was given opportunity. The one thing about the stimulus money that is going on at a theater near you, which really it's going on in your backyard, is that there is funding. There's a wonderful organization here in Harlem, which many of you may know of, called Strive. Strive International has been in the community as workforce development for the last 25 years. What a lot of you may not know is that you can go down and get $15,000 worth of free green certification training, and they have a placement rate of over 70% at $14 an hour or better. Now, that's going on throughout the country. So the one thing that we've found is you don't have to have a four-year degree to be able to count light bulbs in the ceiling, and you don't have to have a four-year degree to understand how to weatherize a home. There's a lot of money hitting the streets. For example, Green Jobs Green New York, or Green Jobs New York, is a $112 million bucket of money that will be hitting the streets in the fall. New York City will probably get approximately $45 million, and that's going to directly help homeowners lower their utility bills. We did a training track here in Harlem back 4 or 5 months ago. We took youth, we took people from the Center of Aging, we took people coming home from prison, we took people that were everyday unemployed and taught them about energy efficiency. And then we hit 125th Street from the Hudson River to the East River on all the street level businesses, and we did a free lighting assessment to analyze the reduction possibilities on 125th Street. When we compiled all the data, and I must pat every one of those young men and women on the back because they all equally participated in the project and brought it to closure, we were able to surmise that just by changing out the light bulbs, we could have saved that street, 125th Street small businesses, $280 million over 10 years. Those are green jobs. That's viable. Those things are right there right now for the taking, and the money is already being spent. So to circle back around and not take up any more time, the obvious is happening, but it's also a matter of engagement and understanding what's going on around you. There are wonderful things happening in Harlem and happening in the five boroughs that people can access. And whether you're, you know, pro-green or against it right now, everybody should be pro-green because the economy is basically broken and a job is a job. But what is going to happen is a lot of the obvious in front of us is going to continue to grow. But again, I'll circle back to what I said earlier, Walker. Small window of opportunity. Big brother always figures it out. Right now, Big Brother's over on the side going, what's this all about? But they're looking, and they're looking very hard. So I would encourage anyone, son, daughter, nephew, yourself, friend, get involved. The industry will not stop. It's quite obvious, I wouldn't take one drop of oil in the Gulf for the exposure that it's going to give to environmentalism and to how we have to look at our planet and save it. But the reality is there's another eye-opener right there in front of us. And we've already seen jobs in the Gulf happening, not the way we want to create green jobs. But at the end of the day, the sector is real. It's viable. It's not hype. It is happening. And the beauty of it all is that people that normally would not have an opportunity are getting the opportunity. So,
very nice. Very nice. And you guys can see why these people are on this panel, because they know exactly what they're talking about. So I feel very lucky to be up here with you guys, because even looking back at taking it back to Michael Jackson and about the call again and how it is really much a call to action, and much of his actions from the panels you've seen throughout the day, he brought things to light and gave us access to things as he was, moving into different social circles, as he was changing, as he was evolving. He still was that connector back to the community, whether you want to call that the black community, the musical community. He was still that connector, because you saw so many things because he was doing it. The most famous person in the world got on TV 10 years before Katrina and predicted it and said, if we do not treat our earth well, this is what happens. And really looking at this panel, I think that we're all trying to honor that legacy and honor that education that Michael brought. I've thought a lot of times to myself, I was raised, to know that, your ancestors built this country, we built this place up, along with many other people from other lands, of course, but the idea of being native to the land that your people broke their back on and were established, the greatness that we call America and land of opportunity. This, we'd be so... It'd just be so unfortunate, I'll just censor myself and say it'd be very unfortunate for any person, but I think especially to those who have ever felt that they are on the outside, marginalized, who have ever felt used and abused by the industries that they work in, that they not take this opportunity and hear not only what Michael spoke of as opportunity, but obviously the green call to opportunity, and to honor that. And so I'd like to ask, before we go into some Q&A, because I think it'd be great to hear some questions from everyone here, how do you see your work in honoring the message Michael's brought to us through Earth Song, and how do you feel you'll be honored? Your work is going to be honoring Michael's message.
Okay, well, something that I got from the video about the participation of communities, and I guess this idea of not making this whole process so top down, meaning we shouldn't have to depend on necessarily people who are in this panel who have education and have had the opportunity to go forward in life to necessarily solve the problems of people in the communities. We need to include a lot of the people in the communities themselves, because oftentimes they really know much better what the problems are than any of us. And I guess, I don't know if I have time. Do I have time to go into an anecdote?
Go for it.
Cool. So I just wanted to sort of reflect on my experience in Brazil and what brought me to this point right now. When I got there under the Fulbright grant, I had a clear understanding of what I wanted to do, but not a clear understanding of what exactly I should have been doing or what concerns there were in the community where I was living. And I was in a slum. I had arrived in the slum via some friends that I knew here in New York, and were doing some work with disabled folks who, I guess... are almost considered invisible in many slum communities, because they're oftentimes in wheelchairs, but there's no transportation to take them in and out of where they live. So they worked with that area. And one of their friends was a guy who lived in the community, and he didn't have a home. He had three kids and a wife, but he didn't have a place to live, actual property title. So I decided, and this is not a good story, so don't... I think people are thinking, oh, he built him a home, what a nice guy. No, that didn't happen. I was trying to do that, but it didn't end up that way. The way that it happened was I decided, okay, yeah, I think I should try to help him build a home. What I can do is use my skills in architecture, my design skills specifically, to help him organize a project in terms of how his home would formerly look like, and then also go into a little bit how the project would be built and how it would be financed. And as we started crunching the numbers and just trying to think of different construction methods, and this actual design for his home was for his family, but it had an access ramp for disabled people. So this was, or differently abled people. So it was supposed to be a different design within the community to sort of follow on the lines of his work and facilitate his work with people who may need wheelchair access. But as we started looking at just how to get the materials to build this, it was just looking way too expensive. And so I started thinking to myself, well, why is this so expensive? A lot of slums in the city of Rio de Janeiro are built on hilltops, and it's often difficult to get materials up there. So transportation was actually promoting the rise in construction, in the prices for construction materials, because it takes gasoline, lots of gasoline, to power a truck to take sand, dirt, cement, bricks, wood, other building materials up to a slum called a favela. And that made me think for a second, well, is there another way we can build? And very randomly, I don't know how I found this professor in a local university who was using bamboo and vegetable fibers to create materials for construction, for, I guess, civil construction. And I thought it was interesting because we always have this, we had this mentality that what's on the market is what we need to consider. So if we're looking at bricks, if we're looking at cement, we're looking at even these types of light bulbs or even this type of lighting system that we have right now, this is what we need to follow. We're indoctrined to follow what we're getting from above. And part of the experience that I thought was interesting was that the people from this community started to generate ideas of their own. And they themselves thought, okay, well, yeah, it makes sense. We have bamboo growing all around us. We have the type of soil that can help us make bricks all around us. We have fibers growing all around us. We can treat them. We just need to know what technologies we can use for this. And that's really where my work went into. So it stopped going into this sort of area of learning how to use design and these skills that I was taught at university and really trying to address core issues that were on the ground. And that brought me over to where I am today, where I'm basically making a proposal for a social enterprise, trying to go back to this community and employ non-conventional technologies to produce alternative materials that use local resources. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think this is a lot of what, this seems like a very long-winded way of looking at it, but what Michael Jackson ultimately wanted us to do was to look at the people themselves, look at their concerns, their environment, and instead of always just getting ideas from above, try to get ideas from them and try to really resolve their issues. And in that, in this idea of my social enterprise is embedded profit. I plan to, at some point, hopefully in the near future, get something rolling so that I can go back down there and train people within that community with a lot of the skills that I received through my university training, and also help develop the skills that they already have so that they can produce materials that are local, ecological, cost less to produce, and can be used to build their homes and address housing issues directly, and also to create a source of income for them so that there's a little bit more of this roundabout idea of how to actually solve people's problems there that go beyond environmental issues and more into profit, housing, etc.
Yeah, very good. So again, creating that access, like sustainability, giving people access to themselves, their own ideas, and new jobs that they're creating. You're going to the people to really determine their own destiny, and that is something that I think is another call. How do we command our own fiscal and physical health? Which is something that, you know, Michael had the access to do. Anissa? How do you feel after that? That was a good story, Andre.
Wow.
I was like, but Anissa, in terms of honoring that call, how do you feel your work and really informing those and managing business opportunities? How do you feel that's an honor?
I don't really have a story to top Andres' story of helping local people in the favela to build their own houses out of bamboo. I think what we're doing is just providing people an opportunity to learn about the space, to get into the green economy wherever they can. I have a co-chair who's a marvelous woman who's been in the green business for 20 years as a green marketer back when they were all tree huggers and everyone thought she was weird. And in the process, you know, she worked for the Energy Star program and it was just starting out. She's worked for Nike, like a lot of the big brands as they got on board. But she likes to say the best way to get into the green business is to start your own, or the best way to get a green job is to start your own. So I think we're kind of empowering people to look around and start where they are. So even if you're in a job, for example, you could become the green expert at your job. And then that's a role for you to become the sustainability expert. Or if you already have a field, you're a marketer, you're a teacher, you can be a green marketer, a green educator. You could be, if you're in finance, you could be a green finance person. If you're, whatever field you're in, maybe there's an opportunity to green that. Right. And then, if you think that you need to get some kind of education to further your entree into the space, it's a good idea to specialize in something. So, for example, there are people who are learning about energy efficiency, and they are experts now, and they have a knowledge that other people don't have. It would be nice to just study sustainability and have a sustainability degree, but that doesn't... You really need an expertise, like more of a hard science or something else to back it in, back it up. You have to be a green something. So a green energy efficiency expert or a green marketer or a green microbiologist or what
finance
have you.
Consultant.
Financial exactly, consultant, yeah. Whatever it is. So I guess what I'm doing and what I'm all about is just helping people to find their place in that movement.
Mm-hmm. And William?
She raised another very interesting, women are always so smarter, very interesting point, and that was that you can become a specialist in just about anything. One of the tracks that we're working on now to just expand the opportunities is green maintenance, teaching people how to do green cleaning. And again, circling these jobs back around in the community where we're seeing a lot of interest in entrepreneurialism. And we've been fortunate that there are a few good loan programs out there that will help people get into green businesses. The manufacturers and the technology, which is the space that I really enjoy playing in, is moving at such lightning speed. And the demand for green has been high. The supply chain has been very low. So there are enormous opportunities right now. We've invested the last 2 years in really proving a lot of models, doing a lot of pilots, and really getting in the trenches to make sure that it will work. And that work was invaluable because now it's paying off tenfold. When I leave here tonight, I'll be traveling south, and we are taking 40 high school students in Georgia, two different high schools, and we've hired local college students from Morehouse and Spelman to mentor them through a two-month program where we'll actually be auditing their schools in the community along with government buildings. Now, these kids are being paid for this work during the 8 weeks from the county. We leveraged everything that we could to connect the dots and make it work. We'll be presenting with the children at the end of the platform back to the CEO of the county and the superintendent of schools. And so it just shows again that, there's value in the actual data, and a lot of people want the data. So we're just leveraging every physical possible thing we can to make it work. We're also putting those kids on a college campus for 3 weeks of that actual training. And we were fortunate enough that our good friend MC, Majora Carter, is actually going to Skype in from Portugal on Monday to open up the session. Mm-hmm. Again, using and leveraging every physical possible thing we can to make it a success. Now, here's the beauty of that. On the seventh week of that platform, these kids are going to go on a field trip to the Gulf. They're going to stay in a resort hotel and audit that hotel as part of their bartering to stay there. And then their final 2 days will be on the Gulf helping with wildlife cleanup from the environmental spill. We're greening these kids. When we're done, they will never, ever forget that summer that they got greened, and hopefully all go on to be amazing technology designers, you know, new forms of energy. But these things are doable right now because we have this window of opportunity. But it is not going to be a window that stays open for very long. So again, I empower you all that if it's something that's on your radar, or you're thinking about, or maybe you want to do, get involved because now is the time. We are already seeing a shift. I was just at a conference in D.C. about a month ago. Labor is stepping in, and we all know what happens when that happens. Big Brother steps in right behind him. So, you know, I again, the work in the community and the community-based things that can be done right now, it's a wonderful time. But you don't seize the moment or the opportunity. I mean, I'm not trying to be, you know, negative, but been there, done that. I've seen these kind of, you know, situations come and go. The door's open right now, and it's wide open. So I would encourage everyone to run through it quickly, close it behind you, and figure out what your green dream is going to be.
Beautiful. That's perfect for Q&A. That's perfect. Wow. And so, sir, thanks for being so patient. Got a lot of good stuff to say. Thank you, guys. This is wonderful.
In relation to Michael Jackson, he was definitely a trailblazer and a trendsetter. You talked about trends. One of the trends that's happening now is online shopping, and Walmart, Best Buy, and even Circuit City, which is a company that a lot of people think that closed down, but they didn't close down. They went to the internet. That's a paradigm shift. And you're talking about a paradigm shift in terms of green jobs. I write for a prison newspaper, and I'm with the Coalition for Parole Restoration. And what I do is I assist young men and women returning back to this community. I also run a support group. And so I would like to say, and I'd like to ask you before I leave, because I have to leave shortly, is two things. If anybody's interested in learning about the trend that's coming on with online shopping, I can give you some information to a program taking place this coming Thursday. But what I'd like to ask you about is how do I connect? I have a number of people who I have a support group that's taking place this coming Tuesday. I know that I'm not expecting for you to do it, but if you can get a representative to come out to my support group, I have formerly incarcerated people coming to that support group, along with families who have loved ones who are still incarcerated and looking to come home. And what they need and what they need most is access to information for jobs, especially if you're talking about a job that's going to pay them $14 an hour or more, and a job that's going to give them the training so that they can learn to basically be able to take care of themselves. I'll wait until after that you can answer, or I'll be more than happy to exchange cards with you and like to find out. You mentioned about I think it was a website that you wanted to give everybody. I don't think we actually got it. So I want to find out, one, that website, and two, how do I connect my formerly incarcerated brothers and sisters coming out of prison with those green jobs?
Well, who I work for, Majora Carter, before she started the Majora Carter Group, I'll first start off by saying that, again, that window of opportunity is, I think, will be the best one for many of those who are coming from, you know, from prison. A lot of the jobs that were started through the BEST program at Sustainable South Bronx, which was Bronx Ecological Stewardship training, where you had a lot of people who otherwise would not be able to go and get a job at a desk immediately, were able to start building their soft skills and their and be paid, you know, while doing more ecological work. And also something that William mentioned before, there are also those great stories that happen very often over at Strive, where you have project managers that get that opportunity. I would say the website, I don't remember, because I should have written that down myself.
Just chime in real quick. The website was in reference to Annie Linage, the story of stuff. But just real quick to address your question, there's two organizations here in the boroughs that I know personally can help your client base immediately. Strive International, right over in Harlem at 123rd and 2nd Avenue in the Harlem Charter Day School building, accepts applications and incoming people on a regular basis. Also, St. Nick's Workforce Alliance in Brooklyn also works with the formerly incarcerated in training and also placement. You must realize these training programs are worth thousands and thousands of dollars. So after the people get all their certification, OSHA, HAZMAT, all those things that they would need to be competitive in the job market, they then are worked with diligently to find employment. So those are two organizations in the boroughs. There are many more, but those two I know of personally that do phenomenal work. And they will speak to you at length and help you in any way that you possibly need the help.
And I would also add the best program to that as well, Sustainable South Bronx. And that's located in the South Bronx at, of course, I went blank on the address.
But it's like Barreto and Lafayette.
Barreto and Lafayette. I was going to say Garrison. There we go. And that's in the South Bronx off Hunts Point stop.
Okay. Well, I know that Michael Jackson's interest in Earth, period, and in the environment was sort of or also informed by his love for animals. And I am curious about what you think it takes to get a young person, or what strategies do you think we should use to contextualize the green movement from young people who are so absolutely disconnected from the green movement? What types of approaches do you think we should use to engage that population?
I'll just comment very briefly, just because of the amount of youth that we've had the privilege of interacting with, and also my experience with my own three small children. One of the things that we've found, and especially with people that have not had opportunity put in front of them, that the minute these youth start to get the empowerment that comes out of learning something new that they typically did not know, there's an immediate transformation. The one thing that I have so enjoyed about the green movement, and I've been involved now for 7 years, and I can't take the claim for, getting involved on my own. My wife actually is the one who got me involved, is that the quality of people that I get to interact with. My colleagues in the green movement, nation and globally, are people that are genuinely concerned and may not have been when they originally started out, but it starts to get infectious. Now, here's the interesting thing about the children. We sponsored a website back when Obama was running for president. I think it's still up. It was called Vote for Me Because I Can't. Mm-hmm. And what we did is we actually went around the five boroughs and we asked children what the number one thing was. If they could pick the president, who would they pick? Not necessarily who, but why. Believe it or not, the environment was the number one choice. The economy was two, and then the war was three. Now, mind you, this has just been a little more than, about a year and a half ago, right before President Obama got elected. I think that, even though, and I cite my son and my daughters all the time, I call them thumb babies, because growing up, we went out and played Army men. We didn't play it on TV. And so I think a little bit of the realism that's been taken out of just everyday interaction is something that needs to be addressed. But I can say one thing honestly about green. Once youth get, and we even see it in senior citizens, we see it in people in general. Once we start to take ownership of, the responsibilities not only we have to ourselves, but really that we have to the planet, it's just like your local neighborhood. It's so important to be concerned, be a parent, be concerned about your neighbor, being concerned about your own, health and wealth and food. But to directly answer your question about the youth, I think that there is an enormous opportunity, and I think they will embrace it wholeheartedly. A lot of it deals in the techie side of what they grew up knowing, So I think there's some coolness to it that bonds them. But I think we have a wonderful opportunity with the youth to get them to lead the charge. We're leaving the planet behind for them. They already realize that if they don't clean it up, there won't be a planet for them to live on. So I think we've got a little bit of a head start.
Can I add to that quickly?
Oh, sure.
Just to add to that quickly, some of the challenges I encounter at the Sustainable Design Lab, I think it has to be fun on some levels.
Yes.
It could be like the most important issue or the most a valuable skill that adolescent can learn at the Sustainable Design Lab. But if it's not interesting to them, if it doesn't engage them on their level, all of a sudden it just flies over their head. So, and it's not, that's not the case with every youth that I deal with, but I feel like because there's a lot of sort of adolescent issues, like their image and their self-esteem and feeling good about themselves. I think William mentioned this perfectly, like they really have to just feel good about what they're doing and really get involved in it for it to be something very relevant to their life. So I think sometimes and this is the issue I have with a top-down approach, we tend to think about this a little bit sometimes way too seriously, and it is a very serious issue, but sometimes we just have to really look at some of these more fundamental things, like how a trend may affect a mindset. If mm-hmm. this is something that involves, like, I don't know, let's say in the case with the physical computing lab where that's right next door to me, but like an example of something, like I have this iPhone right here, and a lot of the students, like, they want to have iPhones or they want to have iPods, and I threw up the idea one day of just making a solar powered cell phone charger or an iPod charger, and I was like, all right, you know, they're walking around, it's summertime, plenty of light, we have from about 5:30 in the morning until 7:30 or 8, something like that, at night, when there's just sunlight. So they're out and about, find a way to clip this thing onto their body. It'll charge their iPod, right? And if we make it fashionable, if we make it nice, then all of a sudden, like, they just start jumping on it. And all we just got to figure out is the logistics to make it work right.
Yeah. Another point, just to the animal point, and with sustainability to add, that you guys have all touched on, is access. And that's a really big takeaway, is that sustainability is about access. You've heard it about access to new funds, access to new jobs. Even when it comes down to Michael Jackson's care for the environment and what it is to know to love an animal for being an animal, and that it's sharing the world with you and respecting that space, a lot of the charter schools are bringing back classroom pets. It's the idea, and that's what's so beautiful, again, about sustainability. The same way it's beautiful to have, you know, kids learning and being exposed to college campuses that are down the street they'd never be on, it's the same issue. You know, it is a paradigm shift. It's a value or a turn to certain values. You know, it's important, instead of running away from anything because it's not made of the concrete. Majora Carter became famous because she took a dump next to a river that no one ever thought existed, that no one knew that the river even touched her part of the Bronx. Her dog drew her in, an animal, drew her into the dump, and it exposed a new mindset for her to say, you know what, this could be a space for people where people commune with nature, and nature's not a bad thing. The same way as, you know, I'm not going to associate working in the field with being a slave, I'm going to associate working for the earth or in a field with, you know, bettering my community and myself. You know, it's all that idea. How do you change, or how do you make the decision to take this multifaceted world and choose the positive aspects that you can bring to it? And so just to add to that, sustainability is about that kind of access that touches us in all kinds of ways. So, hi.
Hi, this is a comment on the impact of Michael Jackson's status as a global pop icon for transnational issues of environmentalism. I was in Hong Kong this past December, and I met with many Michael Jackson fans in Hong Kong, and the ones I met with are between the ages of 15 and 25. And when they talk about Michael Jackson, they talk about three things: his singing, his dancing, and his work for the environment. So, and they've started, there are a bunch of fans there have started a group called Dreamwalker. And Dreamwalker is in talks with various NGOs in Hong Kong that deal specifically with issues of environmentalism. And what's very interesting, too, is that the Dreamwalker group in Hong Kong, there's, you know, tons of Michael Jackson fans in China. And, of course, China's been experiencing a lot of issues of environmentalism, mm-hmm. of, you know, with rapid industrialization. So it's very interesting to see how he's having direct impact in that young people are forming groups where they're trying to deal specifically with issues of environmentalism. So I just thought,
wow,
people would want to know that.
That was great. Yeah. I need to look them up. Dreamwalkers?
Dreamwalker.
Cool. Very nice.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. This is a question for Mr. Thomas. You said that you walked around Harlem with a group of people and identified how ways to make businesses more green. How did you do that? What standards did you use? Was it through a program? Do you have like a brochure or a checklist? Because I'm a fifth grade teacher and I'd love to do that with my kids.
Answer all of the above. So let's see. We'll start with the kid aspect. So I'm not going to embarrass him, but my 13-year-old son's in the audience, right? So last year he got trained as one of the youngest energy auditors in the United States. And I'll have to give him props because, you know, our kids can do whatever they like as long as they make good grades and they come home on time.
There you go.
His first year of middle school last year, he went into the cafeteria, realized they didn't have any recycling bins. So he had every student in the sixth grade sign a petition to get those recycling bins, and they got them. The program is a pretty simple and straightforward program. When we did the project on 125th Street, we have our own proprietary software that we validate energy auditing with, but there are several different things that are available to model energy efficiency. This particular program was done in conjunction with Strive International, and we were actually training their students, their client base on energy efficiency. I'd be more than glad to talk to you offline because I can't take up the whole time of the panel, but programs within the school are great because, first of all, it brings a sense of ownership to the student that this is their property. They should maintain it and take care of it. But what's amazing is that how it transforms the adults in the school to take a little bit closer look at what maybe is going, well, not maybe, is obviously going on. But these type of programs are just nothing more than, you know, when I got involved in this sector 7 years ago, it was like, well, you're doing what? You know, like, what? And I was like, yeah, you'll see. So we just kept on drilling down. But the long and short of it is that these initiatives, these pilot programs, are nothing more than taking the responsibility to get up off your tush and get something done. People spend way too much time in the politics of making things happen. So, you know, you have a school, simple. Grab a group of students that are interested in, you know, or maybe not interested in the planet and will be when they're done, and start just the education cycle of how do we consume energy? Where does energy come from? I mean, the average person doesn't even know how it transforms from the power plant all the way to your home. These are interactive things that, believe it or not, most youth are interested in once they get the opportunity to understand what it is. It's just like, you know, the sun. I was reading something on Tree Hugger the other day. There's a new plan to put solar on the moon with power the whole earth. So, you know, these things are just, they're out of the box, but really they're not. They're the obvious next evolution of technology. And we just need to embrace those. And we need to put that in front of our youth, because the one thing that our youth have taught us is that there are no boundaries. You know, the way they communicate, the things that they're involved in. But we as parents and nurturers and, you know, and educators must show them the things that are coming down the pike instead of being the ones always shown. So I definitely would love to have the conversation, be more than glad to help you in any way. But even my third grader in second grade was starting little programs within her school because she wanted to mimic mom and dad, because that's what mom and dad were doing. I think once you put it out there, you'll find that a lot of people will embrace it and they do want it, and we will create these new Majora Carters and all these wonderful people that will come down the pike and help save the planet, make the world a better place to live in.
And there you go. So I would say this would be a good place to close. This is wonderful. Thank you so much. Clapping in the mic. But Mr. Andres Carter-Marino, Ms. Anissa Keith, and Mr. William Thomas, thank you very much for giving us your time today. This was a wonderful experience, and I'm glad you guys were here to share it with us.
And thank you, Walker Sands.
Thank you
very much. Thank you, guys. It's amazing that Michael Jackson has us talking about everything. about all of these things. And so it's a brilliant thing to be able to learn through just having discussions about his life and how much we will be able to take away. We're very clear that we did not answer all the questions and that this was actually designed to have us just begin to think about, you know, all these things that surround his life, i.e. our lives. And so we welcome you and appreciate the fact that you came. For some of you, you've been here since last night from 6 p.m. until right now. Donna, again, you got it, Michael Jackson. and it just, again, speaks to this man's brilliant magic, you know, complexity. And what he leaves behind is an opportunity for us to continue to look at, I mean, and not to be corny and cliche, but the man in the mirror, the woman in the mirror is a real thing. What can we do to change our world? And so thank you guys. I would also like to, again, thank the Schomburg for hosting this. I think we should give them a round of applause. Yeah, and Clarice in particular, who has done a wonderful job of creating important programs for the Schomburg, and I hope that we continue to support this institution. I don't want to ever hear a story about the Schomburg closing because, you know, they needed to close, period. So we need to definitely support this institution. Thank you, Clarice, and thank everyone for coming.